Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas Podcast. Today, we have a very special guest, Professor Susan Long. Susan is a research lead at NIOD Australia, formerly a professor at RMIT University Melbourne. She supervises PhD students and teaches at various universities, including INSEAD in Singapore. Susan also works as an organizational consultant and specializes in organizational change, executive coaching, board development, role analysis, and team development. Susan was a founding president of the Group Relations Australia and a past president of the International Society for the Psychoanalytic Study of Organizations, ISPSO, where we met. Susan has published books and journals, and she's contributed significantly to the fields of organizational dynamics, leadership, and psychoanalytic study. Her most recent book, which we're going to discuss today, is The Evolution of the Unconscious. Susan is a leading thinker in our field. I'm really delighted you're here, Susan. You're very welcome. How are you today?
Good. Thanks, Simon. Yeah, I'm sort of happy to talk with you about this as much as I'm able. Yeah,
I'm eagerly. I've ordered your book. I've not read it, but we've talked about some of the ideas. So you're tracing the ideas of the unconscious, and you go pre-Freud. Should we start pre-Sigmund Freud and just say something about Schelling, I think it is, and other influences?
Yeah. Well, look, let me just say, I've been interested in the unconscious as an idea since I can't remember when. Way back. Always interested in, even as a child, what's the human mind about? What is our thinking about and what lies behind it? And I think way back in history, people have always thought what the people's behavior, thoughts and feelings are influenced by, sometimes by things that they're completely unaware of. And somebody else might see something and say something and bring it to somebody's awareness. So I think that sort of the idea is that there's something there behind what we consciously think about, or what we think we're thinking about, has always been there as an idea. And I think it's sort of a fascinating idea. And so I have always been interested, and I have been psychoanalytically trained, and I guess I was filled with the idea of the unconscious from a psychoanalytic perspective. But when I started to look into trying to understand where it came from as an idea, how it emerged and how it's developed, I came across, of course, the notion that it was there well before Freud, and people have written about this. And so I became interested in the philosopher, one of the German romantic philosophers, you can call him, Schelling, and a contemporary of Hegel, and wanted to sort of start looking at his work, because I read that he was the first one to systematically use the term the unconscious. Mm. I think as an idea it was hanging around for a long while, but he used it systematically and talked about it in his writings. So I started to explore that and started to look at some of his writings and went back to some of his original stuff. And of course it's written from the culture of his time. So he talks a lot from a sort of what seems like a religious perspective, talks about God. Yeah. But for me, it's interchangeable with his idea of spirit, what spirit is. And so I wanted to explore that through the lens of the unconscious. And I was delighted when reading Schelling's work. First of all, I was delighted because in the first part of his thinking, the unconscious was in nature, and I'm very much a person who, I live in the Australian bush, I love animals, and I feel very connected to nature. So reading that Schelling said the unconscious is nature Spirit is nature. Spirit becomes evident in nature. He developed and changed his ideas throughout life, as we all do.
Yeah.
Some of his later work I also became very interested in, because as I read through parts of what he says, kind of it predates the Freudian and the psychoanalytic ideas of the unconscious. You can read in there bits of Bion, bits of Freud. You can read Lacan. You can read Jung. It's all a precursor in a different sort of language, yes. And yeah. I don't think we should use current language to look back and judge him. I think we should judge his work on the basis of where it came from. But yes, so I start by an examination of my reading of Schelling.
Yeah, I mean, I've not read Schelling deeply, but it is so interesting how many of the ideas are captured there. And that link between pre-modern thinking, indigenous thinking around kind of the unconscious as spirit and the unconscious as nature, there's connections there as well, isn't there?
Absolutely. And as I work through the book, I trace that as kind of a thread. But, you know, I've been sort of working on thinking about this book for a few years. And unapologetically, I've looked at the ideas of the unconscious and said, look, there's so much there. How could anybody dare to write a book on the evolution of this idea? What a kind of strange thing to do, because there's so much there. I can't hope to even touch only a small portion of it. But it's done unapologetically from my own way of thinking. I've looked at the theorists that have influenced me in my career and shaped my understanding of the unconscious as an idea. And so in that regard, of course, I wrote the book largely for myself as I worked through it, but also hoping that people might say, well, if this person is looking at a concept from her own personal development as a professional and as a person, I can do it too. Look at how an idea has shaped you and how you come to it. It links in with my work on roles and thinking about the history of the roles that you take up in your life and how they shape you. The book is partly about how it's shaped my idea of the unconscious, moving from Schelling to Freud to some of the other psychoanalysts. Bion and Lacan in particular have influenced me, and then moving on to a lot of the ideas of the social implications of the unconscious, looking at some social scientists and so on, and sort of moving there to ideas about kind of current ideas. It's still evolving as an idea, sure. Yeah. It will die if it's no longer useful.
No, it's very interesting. And I want to come to the social scientists piece later, but I think it's important for listeners who aren't deeply kind of involved in psychoanalytic thinking that you make the point that I think many people think of this, the unconscious, that they have this idea of the iceberg, and it's the it's an individual thing, and in each individual we have hidden depths, and you say it's more than that, don't you? You link it to groups and to social kind of processes as well, which Bion and Lacan do as well. Do you want to say something about the beyond individual unconscious?
Yes, well, I mean, I think Freud was a great social theorist as well. I mean, he's mostly known for his clinical work and his work with individuals and his case studies and so on. But he does venture into thinking about his ideas in terms of history and social situations and groups. And although for Freud, we tend to think of the repressed unconscious, that which for most people, it's looking at things that have happened in your life that have been so uncomfortable you can no longer look at them. You can no longer consciously be aware of them. So they get repressed. And of course, then there's the concept of the return of the repressed. Whatever you've repressed, it's going to come back somewhere. It's going to give you away. It's going to find its way back into your behavior or into your feelings or into your thoughts. But Freud also talked about an unconscious that wasn't repressed, was there, and perhaps can never be really understood. I think that's his heritage from Schelling as well, because I think that comes from there. But yes, so there's that side of psychoanalytic theorizing that has been there to psychoanalyze people and help them and let them see where unbearable thoughts can be thought about again and not cause terrible anxiety and depression and so on. But yes, moving to Freud did start talking about groups and how unconscious processes work in groups. Unconscious ways in which we link to others, the way in which we, in our egos and in our superego or our ego ideal, we start to link to others, that we have something inside us, in our own minds. And I must admit, this is a bit of a side thing, but in doing this book, I had to struggle with my idea of what a mind is, because how can you think about an unconscious mind without thinking about what a mind is? That's, by the way, and I try to do that a little bit in some of the chapters. But then moving into this sort of group that we incorporate in ourselves more than ourselves. We incorporate thoughts and feelings, or maybe thoughts. I'll stick with thoughts. Ideas, ways of thinking, ways of being, ways of behaving that come to us through culture, through other people, through the groups that we belong to. And our mind is not just an individual mind. We're part of something greater. And I like the simile of language. We don't make up our own languages. We share it. We share a language with an interacting group of people. And its language belongs to the group, not to the individual. Now, we might make up some neologisms, or we might make up various things, new words and so on. They happen all the time. But it is in the community. Language belongs to the community. And I think that's the basis. Mind belongs to the community. And we are a small representation of a much greater thing that might be called mind. Now, people might think I'm a bit crazy here, because the idea of a mind gets caught with the idea of something that's in your head, that belongs to your brain, that sits behind your eyes. But not all cultures have thought about it that way. I do think that the brain is important. It's a substructure. But the mind is something that transcends that, is emergent from that. And I try to trace the nature in the book of emergence and transcendence and what that means in terms of mind, and therefore in terms of unconscious mind. But yes, when it comes to the social, I think I've been influenced a lot by some of the mid-20th century thinkers, and Frankfurt School, for example, and some of those critiquing people there, who look at the way in which an idea gets embedded in a group mind. But more than embedded in a group mind, it gets embedded in the structures that those minds have created. Our buildings, our various institutions like the law and education, they're all embedded with something that belongs to us all, that we share, what I call the associative unconscious, I guess.
Yeah, and this is very interesting, and I think this is very difficult for the modern mind. Like, I mean, the individual with the mind inside the cranium idea, it is a very kind of modern idea. Like, before modernity kind of imposed that idea, people did have a much more ecosystemic idea of how we functioned with nature, with kind of the spirit world around us, a different language. But when I'm teaching on my courses, I talk about how the social speaks through us and the unconscious always speaks through us. It's like there's like the scaffolding, the individuals are scaffolded to kind of the buildings, the culture around us, aren't they? And the unconscious is part of that kind of scaffolding and kind of forms the way we think, the way we feel, the way we relate. It's kind of very much a relational and associative kind of idea, isn't it?
It is. And I think each of us, I think this is a lovely idea, much better than this sort of narcissistic individual thing, that each of us holds a piece of something much greater that we share. And yes, we're the voice for that piece, but the only way in which we can actually come to something that connects us and might help us solve some of the problems that we put ourselves into is if we communicate with each other. Our peace of mind gets shared with the peace of mind of others so that we can come to a bigger picture. And yes, I do think that our individual lives, each individual life is so precious because it each contains a part of that greater thing, whether it's in nature or whatever, that then gets expressed through that life and can communicate with others. Each individual holds a precious piece, an individual piece, yes, but a piece that's part of something. That's how I see it. It's a bit like a jigsaw puzzle. Everything's every fitted together, a bigger picture can come. And so I don't think we have to let go of the beauty of our individuality, but we mustn't let it become as if that's the only thing, as if narcissistically it's the only thing. We're part of something bigger. And each of the theorists that I've looked at, I've tried to see how they fit in with that, how Bion does in terms of his thinking of the unconscious as the infinite. I take a quote from, I've just forgotten his name now. Sorry, a physicist who's often on the television a lot, a British guy. And he says that we are the universe being able to show itself, to be itself.
Yeah.
We are an expression of the universe, each one of us.
Yeah.
And that idea comes from Schelling, but it washes through a lot of these ideas that theorists have of the unconscious.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting for me how, like you say, Freud did, you know, Civilization as Discontent. He wrote on groups. Schelling wrote about the unconscious, the spirit as nature. These ideas have been there, but there seems to be quite a pressure in the system to reduce psychoanalysis or reduce the unconscious, one, to an individual level, and two, to a wounded self, what I call. So a kind of a pathologizing, repressive unconscious. And the wider understanding of how our libidinal cells, our collective libidinal cells, inform art and creativity, it's there, but it's often not been surfaced enough. So I'm glad you're writing about it.
I think it's surfaced elsewhere than often in the community that grown out of psychoanalysis, because that community has been very much involved with the clinic and with individual pathology, and even our consulting communities often grown into a kind of a organizational pathology laboratory.
Yes.
So we look for wonderfully, and I think it's done it really well and needs to continue to do that in terms of, you know, social defenses and so on. But we need to go beyond that and to find not just what the social defense is, but how to actually help the creativity. And I do think that some areas outside of psychoanalysis or psychology, maybe the arts and maybe, as you say, some indigenous thinking and some anthrozoology thinking, how we're connected with nature and how we're connected into animal life and ecological life. I think that's going to be the way to try and get us to the creative side rather than just the pathology side. Both are important developments, but
I mean, a lot of the positivistic psychology kind of avoids a shadow side, and I'm glad psychoanalysis doesn't avoid it. It does kind of face into some of the more difficult dynamics in organizations and in society. But I do think this ecological unconscious, ecological creativity, I think we are alienated and disconnected from, again, it's a modern trait, from nature. We've used nature as a resource without thinking about kind of it as a being part of us and living. So that is a work to do. Can you say something about the Frankfurt School, your research around the Frankfurt School and what they did with the unconscious and how they used it to understand society and politics?
Well, I link this, of course, with Marxist theory and Eric Fromm and his ideas of trying to bring psychoanalytic thinking and Marxist thinking together. But for me, that's around the whole area of how ideologies and become embedded in our cultural structures. I mean, you can see it. It's frightening the way it's happening in politics again nowadays, isn't it? I mean, if we get right into that, I'm not an expert on politics. So. But, you know, to just see some of those right-wing ideas emerging again, burning books, for heaven's sakes. And, just some of those ideas that are coming in around the world are a bit frightening. And I think what the Frankfurt School was looking at, how our mind, what we call mind, again, if we can think of it as something other than just this thing that sits in the brain behind your eyes, if we can think of it as some sort of big field that we're in, just the same as we're in energetic fields in the world and the field of light and so on, we're in a mind field. Interesting that could be thought about in two ways, a mind field and a mine field. We're kind of in that, and then it becomes embedded in the culture. It becomes realized or concretized in the culture around us. And it's that, you know, that human beings can be so creative and they can be so destructive. And, you know, if the destructive side becomes embedded in cultures and we all go along with the learning, we have to go along with it in a day-to-day basis. How can you get out of it? You have to live. You have to work within the economic structure that's there, because you've got to make your money. You've got to be able to buy your food and all of that sort of thing. We're embedded in something that has actually come out of the human mind.
Yeah.
How can we're also embedded in more creative sides of things. There are a lot of really wonderful things. I'm so happy that I'm in modern medicine. I'd be dead now with some of the illnesses that I've had if it wasn't for modern medicine. Yeah, good and bad. But it's our mind that creates things. And I do come towards the end of the book to look again at each of the theories in terms of spirit. And I think spirit belongs to the group, to the whole, to the culture. And I don't think in terms of, it may be that we have an individual soul and that's our little bit of the bigger spirit. But I think that somehow, as well as tapping into our scientific ways of thinking, brilliant ways of thinking, I admire a lot of scientists, really do.
Yeah.
And the climate scientists should be listened to more. They've done wonderful things. But also, I think, as well as the scientific way of thinking, there's a kind of a spirit that lives in community and in culture and in, I think there's a spirit amongst different animal groups.
Yes.
I know there's a spirit to the horse. I do a lot of work with horses. And the horse as a species has a shared spirit. Birds, particular birds, have a shared spirit. And I think humanity has a shared spirit. So I think we've got to look at the unconscious as linking in with that. What does it mean that our minds, collective minds, can think creatively and destructively? And how is that? Something about a collective mind for me is spirit. So I'm trying to work my way through that and look at it in terms of the unconscious, because the unconscious is a mind that somehow got set into particular patterns a whole community and communal way of thinking in particular patterns. I know different segments of society and people think differently, but they're, I don't know. I'm struggling with this.
Yeah, no, these patterns are very difficult. I mean, it's interesting if you look at just landscapes. I think landscapes, they are sort of a concrete reflection of our unconscious, you know. So if you look, if you could, like urban landscapes from a few hundred years ago, the tallest buildings would have been the churches. Today it's the banks, and it's you know, they represent their unconscious representations of where power lies and where our cultures what we value and what we don't value. They're there for us to see, and how we treat nature tells us something about ourselves beyond the individual. Yeah. As you say, I think paying attention to this is absolutely vital, and of course in Australia the Indigenous and First Nations peoples have so much to teach us in this, don't they?
I think they do, yes. Certainly been interested in what they've been saying and thinking about that. And the link to nature. I think there's also other strands. Like, I think some of the neuroscience work on the unconscious, Mike Solms and his group, are also interesting. I think they've got another take on it, which can help us understand a bit more about the link between brain and mind. As I said, I think mind is something that belongs to a bigger place, but it's emergent. When we need a brain, without a brain, we wouldn't have a mind. It's there as a substance out of which something, you know, it's the hardware for our software.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think some of that is interested in looking at, we've tended to think of mind and thinking is coming out of the cortex and out of logical thinking and, you know, all of that, whereas they're looking more at the old brain and the emotional aspect of human beings. And as we know, at least, and psychoanalysis has taught us this, that, you know, the emotional life is so important. It dominates. Logic is just a byproduct, you know. Rationalized to fit our emotions. And so I think some of the work on looking at the emotional side of things and the unconscious from that perspective is interesting too. And I went back, I don't know if you're familiar with a theorist called Julian James. Are you?
No.
He talked about the bicameral mind. And he influenced me way back in the 70s or 80s, somewhere around there. And so I have a look at him in the book. I have a look at his theory in the book. And he says that we used to, human beings, back in the age before language, when we were still primordial or cave people or whatever, would hear their own thoughts, if they had them, as coming from the gods from outside. So he says that the mind at that stage was not an inner space where I reside, but was just like an animal mind, perceived, thought, did things, because animals think. And in my chapter on nature, I've given a lot of evidence of animals' capacity to think. And he says that it was when language started to come in that his theory is fairly complex, I won't go through it all, but people started to develop what he called an inner space. And this inner space became the mind, that then people could hear their own voice talking to themselves, which became their thinking, as against the gods talking to them. So he goes through a whole historical thing. And I found that really interesting at the time, because I think that his ideas about how maybe his theories are, they're still accepted by some people nowadays, but how did we create, I always find it as we're talking before, how did we create this idea of an inner space inside us that was us and did the thinking? And it's dominated, hasn't it? That's what we believe in now. we believe in now. So that collective space seems like it's mad. Like, no, it's not that. We've got this inner space. But at least there are many theorists suggesting that that inner space that became me and I took some time in human evolution to develop. And it's not the only space. And that sometimes we fall back into what he called the bicameral mind. We fall back into just this kind of space where the external, maybe the unconscious, is influencing us. Anyway, I just found that interesting.
I think it's very interesting. I actually think it's super important for humans to move and understand that. And like you say, it's not to get rid of an intelligent mind which can do science or a rational mind, but it's very much about being reconnected to a whole, reconnected to a cosmos, because I think we have become very alienated, and you know, all the mental health problems we face these days is something to do with being disconnected and being alone with these thoughts in our heads. There's something very troubling about that. I mean, the other research, which is, there's huge research now in neuroscience, but the other interesting things I'm reading about is like the idea of intelligence. So now we have artificial intelligence and questions around that. But also like people studying octopuses and just how intelligent they are, and yet they don't have a brain. You know, they have different ways of sensing the world around them.
Absolutely.
And it's fascinating, but we don't really understand it. But like it challenges this idea, the kind of the solitary brain thinking again.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it does too. And I think a lot of that, there are different ways, completely different ways of being and thinking about things like that.
Susan, it's been lovely talking to you.
While you were talking, I've lost it. It's slipped away. I'm not quite sure what it was. I'll try and think about it.
Go on.
Sure. No, we're coming to the end. We've been gone enough. I could go on for ages. That's the trouble. I'd want to come back to the psychoanalytic one, though.
Because please do.
That's right. That's my thought. Particularly, and I know you're a Lacanian, and I've tried my hardest to work with Lacanian theory. And got somewhere. I've got my place with it. Just, I come to the end of the chapter where I discuss Lacan, talking about the position that we're left in with him, which is a very bleak position. And I don't know if I think it still lingers there in a lot of our thinking. And that's why it's really hard to move into just finding the creative side. You know, from the Lacanian perspective, we either choose to be true to our desire, live what we are, which is not going to fit the world that is in reality, or we can choose to be sunk in the illusion that's offered us by society at any one time. We've got the societies that we've got at this time. Others in the past had other ones, and so on and so on. And so we can be true to our kind of more animal being, be lost in this illusion. And both of those solutions are a bit bleak, I find. And I find that that's what we struggle with, those choices at each moment of deciding the choices and the hopeful, creative position in the middle, if we could find it, would be wonderful. But we seem to be caught within this illusion that society, with its problems, it's an estranging place, estranged from our true nature. We're either estranged or we're mad. We're either mad or estranged.
Yeah,
anyway,
no, I
I'm
agree.
Not sure
I mean,
if I fully agree with Lacan, but it's an interesting
position. I don't fully agree. I mean, I'm interested in Lacan. I think a lot of his work is very very helpful, and I'm undergoing a Lacanian analysis, and it's very interesting, but I'm not a devotee, and I do think there's a bleakness which I don't actually agree with. And even the formulation that it's almost like a Christian kind of formulation of like, we got thrown out of the Garden of Eden. Like, you know, it's like once we discover language, we're forever separated from the world. And I don't agree with that. I think it's too bleak again. And I think that, you know, a lot of the Khan's work, I think is really helpful. A lot of it is still troubling, you know. So I agree with you. I think there's another way. We're going to end, Susan. It's been absolutely beautiful.
Okay.
I have a question I ask guests. I don't know if you have any thoughts. I always think about kind of what it means to live a good life and what it means to create a good society. These big questions underpin this sort of podcast. And with your focus on the unconscious, you've said quite a lot about that already. But do you want to just say something about how your reading of the unconscious and your work can help us think about living a good life and creating a good society? Any thoughts at all?
Well, for me, it's about we have a responsibility to pay attention to unconscious processes and face the truths that lie therein, whether it's societal or personal, to face, I think we have a human ethical responsibility to face the difficulties and not shirk them, not to cover them over or deny them, but have the courage to face up, notwithstanding that doesn't mean to rush foolishly into kind of exposing everything just like that, but to find the way to face them and work through. Yeah, I think psychoanalysis has really given us that. But I think that the unconscious mind in nature and spirit also does that. I think facing what's difficult and what's going to be true and good for more than just the individual person, more than just one's own ego, but to choose, yeah. It's very difficult, isn't it? But I think facing up to things, if you want a little cliche, is kind of
Susan, important. It's been a real privilege. I hope you keep writing and sharing your thoughts. You're one of the leading thinkers for me. I love your work. So thank you so much indeed. Privileged talking to you. And I'll see you at some ISPSO event in the future, I'm sure. So take care.
Thanks, Simon. Thank you.